Hey, what's your problem? You have business problems? We have business solutions. Well, maybe.
Yeah.
Life is a fight.
It is.
In business, every day is a fight.
Every day.
So, hey, what's your problem?
Yes, thank you, John David Wells, the big voice guy of the show. Check him out at the Wells Report on Facebook. From the Big.HQ in Spring Hill, Tennessee, check us out for anything lighting, electrical, and now heating and air. Just go to Big.Inc.com. The What's Your Problem podcast is all about business owners and professionals in and around Middle Tennessee and sometimes beyond who, it's always something. One of the most poignant things that Greg Miles, one of my former coworkers, told me, and it made my life so much better, was, man, it's always something. Hey, this is a video and audio podcast, so check us out at whatsyourproblempodcast.com from Pick Your Poison. If you want to watch this for whatever reason and see my mug, knock yourself out. Probably better off listening to it on your bike ride, on your commute, on your walk. Speaking of me, I am your host, Jim McCarthy, with jimmccarthyvoiceovers.com. And today, we, not necessarily a business, but somebody of note here in Spring Hill who's got a lot of favorable followers and a lot of people who love what he does. Please welcome to the show, Jay Strother.
Well done.
Not Strother.
Well done.
Thank you.
I played basketball for years and years growing up in Illinois, and the guy on the radio could never get it right.
Your last name.
But you got it right.
Thank
you. The very first time.
Well, I may have practiced and checked. You've got some people in the building here who are a little biased.
There you go.
They're big fans of Jay Strother, yeah. That's for sure. And you and I have met on a surface level here and there. I've gone to a couple different services, met you, I believe, at John Warner's house.
Sounds
when he was
about
moving
right.
in.
Yeah.
Which was really cool.
It's a way to bond right away, moving a couch up a step.
That's right.
Of stairs.
You really find out who a person is.
Who your real friends are. They'll show up to help you move.
Right on, man. To get things going, we got something called the Random Five. The Random Five is brought to you by Kalioka Company, a great brand. Jay, if you walk into the church one day and you go, what in the world is that? It smells like cat urine. Who brought their cat here? Kalioka Company can actually take care of that scent.
That is good to know.
Yeah, I know. They've got this thing. It's little probiotics that are hungry for bad scent bacteria.
Well, that's applicable because we run a Mother's Day Out program. So there are preschoolers at the church clogging up our toilets with all kinds of things. So.
Well, they have all sorts of products that can help you with alleviating that. Check them out. Links in the description. Kalioka Company. .com. Also, we're going to do the random five, which are five completely random questions. Gets the energy moving. And right now, because of our lovely internet fun issues that we have in this building, the compound here at Big Dot, I have it pulled on up on the computer behind me,
sure.
Which is great for my neck. So here we go. Question number one. If you didn't care at all what people thought of you, what clothes would you wear?
Oh, that's an incredible question. Let's see. What if I didn't care what people thought, what would I wear? I think I'd go back to being, 5 years old and basketball shorts and, a baseball t-shirt every day.
I was about to say diapers.
Oh.
That's when you truly don't care about what people
That's
wear.
True. That's true. Some, you know.
Yeah, you know.
Most of us will get there again.
I just don't have time. Yeah, I just don't have time to go to the bathroom. I'm just going to do it right here.
Yeah, yeah.
So question number two, what are you interested in that most people haven't heard of?
Ooh, my goodness. Eschatology.
Eschatology is the study of end times.
That's right.
Thank you.
Well done.
Yeah. I kind of know a few things here and there. Not as well read as most of the people around Spring Hill, but
that's on point.
Yeah. So question number three, I believe it's number three, right? Yeah. Was that number three or number four?
Number three.
That was number three. So we're now where this is now number four?
No, this is three.
This is three. I was in radio, I can't count. For a pastor, this is gonna be a very interesting question.
All right, here we go.
What's your go-to casino game? If you have one.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we used to sit around and play penny poker in, you know, Christian college.
Sure.
That's where I went. It was a little Christian school. And so we used to play various versions of that. So, you know.
That's high stakes right there.
That is, absolutely. And that's how I used to pay for some of my dates. You know, the Pizza Hut was by, you know, just bring in a bag full of pennies after I won.
Do you long poker, for, so. Do you ever long for those days? The simpler times.
Oh, I mean, I think everybody waxes nostalgic about, yeah. You know, there was just a time when things seemed simpler. The ironic part now is I have kids that are at that age and they can't wait to grow up.
Right.
And I just can't, I tell them, I can't wait till you're a parent and I get to watch you at this stage.
See, I used to woodshed in my parents' basement playing the drums and I couldn't wait to get out of the basement.
Right.
Now I can't wait to get back in. Have my own.
Yeah, it comes full circle.
It does. What languages do you wish you could speak?
Oh, wow. Well, I know I can read them, but I can't speak them. Hebrew, Old Testament, Greek, New Testament.
And you can so read them.
Yeah. I mean, really? You know, as far as being able to study at a functional level, you hit that in seminary. But
nice. But so was that sweet. Four questions or five?
That was five. I think that was it. Right. There
we go. I'm expecting you to keep track. That should be my job. But, you know, hey, I'll pay you after for that role. As we finish up here. Thank you for being on. I really do appreciate
it.
And we're going
to
take a quick break. Be right back and get into it with all things Jay Strother from Station Hill Church here in Spring Hill, Tennessee.
Henry Ford once said that if you need a machine and don't buy it, then you will ultimately find that you have paid for it and don't have it. Nothing could be truer about energy-efficient LED lighting in your business. At Big Dot Lighting, we can show you how a portion of your savings from a commercial LED lighting upgrade will be paid for in hardly any time at all. Until then, you're paying for them anyway. Book a no-cost lighting energy assessment with Big Dot Lighting. At least 30% of your utility bill is waiting to be saved. Go to BigDotLighting.com.
All right, getting into it with Mr. Pastor. Is it Mr. or Pastor?
Reverend, if you want to be technical, but
really?
I never go by that. You can just call me Jay.
Jay. Pastor,
that
Reverend
works.
Jay. Mr. Jay. People call you Mr. Jay or just Jay?
A lot of times Pastor Jay in our culture, that's what, you know, parents are like, they want to be sure their kids are being respectful. So that's the route they usually take. Now, I lived in North Alabama for 4 years, so everybody's brother there. So I was Brother Jay.
Oh, really?
I know it's one of my friends from North Alabama. If it's like, hey, Brother Jay, just leaving you a voicemail, checking in on you.
Isn't it kind of funny to maybe to correct people every now and then and say, no, Brother Jay. Let's get it correct.
Yeah, be the Reverend, right?
How did everything begin with you? Go back to the beginning.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well,
tell me how you got here.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Southern Illinois, a little town. I tell people small towns are great places to be from because you learn small town values, work ethics, all of those kind of things. And I grew up like a lot of other guys, sports, cars, and girls, right? Those were the things I was interested in. Playing basketball and baseball, had a 1970 Mustang, went to a small Christian college outside of St. Louis, about 40 miles into Illinois, called Greenville College, now Greenville University. Felt like God was nudging me towards ministry then, but I got my degree to teach and coach because in the Midwest, most churches are smaller. You usually have to do the bivocational angle.
Right.
But had an opportunity to go to inner city Baltimore as a coach. And so I did that for a year with a ministry called Cross Point. And so we did basketball, baseball, clinics, various sports in the inner city. Incredible eye-opening opportunity for me. But I met a pastor from North Alabama. So took my first full-time ministry position right after we got married in North Alabama. I worked primarily with teenagers for that first stretch. And got my seminary degree from New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary there. And then 20 years ago, right about now, Brentwood Baptist Church called me. And so I came up here to be youth minister. That church just exploded with growth. And
right.
So we bought a house in Spring Hill because I couldn't afford to live in Brentwood 20 years ago on a youth minister salary.
That was 20 years ago.
And I now, right, it's hard to live in Spring Hill on a youth minister salary. But the way things have grown around here. But what had happened was the church was growing. We were out here. So we were kind of commuting to church and we loved our church and we loved our neighbors. And we began to just have our neighbors over for barbecues and, you know, Bible studies and things. And we began to realize, hey, come with us to church. It's too far. It's too big, you know? And so we thought, there's a lot of people in this growing town. And so in essence, we just decided we'd bring the church to them.
Right.
So we took the basics of what we did up at the Brentwood campus and we brought them down here and we pushed together the names of the two towns that we were right on the border of, Thompson Station and Spring Hill, and we started the church at Station Hill 11 years ago.
Oh, that's what the derivation of the name.
It is.
Okay.
Here's how creative I am, Jim.
Wow.
We were leasing a space back behind the Kruger Marketplace.
I remember that.
I look out my office window. It's about 400 feet from the town line between Thompson Station and Spring Hill. Right. What are we going to call this thing? The church at Station Hill works. And there you go.
See, I thought Station Hill was a biblical reference all this time.
No. There are a lot of those in church names. But no, all of our campuses are named after the community they're in. And
really?
So we just felt like we just simply want to be the church of Jesus in whatever community or neighborhood God allows us to be. So that's the reason.
And what was the reason for the explosive growth that Brentwood Baptist saw? What was the draw?
Yeah, I don't think there's any one thing. I mean, right. Of course, you know, if I'm going to be in preacher talk, you know, well, it's the Lord, it's the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of factors. One is the church has had an incredibly consistent history of stable leadership. And as you may know, that's rare in a lot of churches. We're 51, 52 years old now. We've had two past senior pastors in the history of the church.
Oh, wow.
And so consistent leadership, consistent vision, a consistent focus on scripture. Whereas some traditions have drifted, don't put as much emphasis there. People still love to hear the Bible taught. And so we've been blessed with excellent communicators, Bible study leaders. And then the other piece that I think is really important is that, you know, the church is the one organization in the world that doesn't exist for itself. It exists to serve others and to reach others. And so an outward focus, you know, an inward strength, I would say, organizationally and with good leadership, but also this outward constant focus towards how can we serve our community? How can we help people throughout the world? Jesus in the Bible, in the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 8, basically gives us our charge and says, you're going to be my witnesses, and you're going to start right here at home, which for the disciples, that was Jerusalem. You're going to go to Judea, which is your region, which is for us, Middle Tennessee. And so we have what we call the Middle Tennessee Initiative. Each one of our churches partners with community ministries in poverty, healthcare, and education. We all have partners in those areas to serve our region. And then Samaria, Jesus told them, was just cross-culturally and then to the ends of the earth. And so we try to be intentional about being sure that we partner with like-minded ministries to reach and help people, you know, here, there, and everywhere, as we like to say.
Does it get to the point after 20-plus years of doing what you're doing, And feeding your family and things of that nature, there's got to be elements that make you roll your eyes eventually. You know, that you just kind of, you hear maybe a skeptic and it's the same old arguments and smoke screens. I mean, I actually, like your gifting and your, what you're into is the eschatology end times study, which is a very interesting subject I'd like to touch upon. I've always felt like mine was apologetics.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Fantastic.
The data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? Yeah, I think there's always consistent things that pop up, you know, from time to time. And you know, I think the thing that I feel challenged with the most or whatever that I roll my eyes at, so to speak, is this idea of what I would call a caricature version of God, the church, Christianity, you know, the one that gets lampooned in all of the movies, on all of the sitcoms, you know, and because people haven't taken time to really, you know, just even dig in at all to understand the basic Christian message. And so how it gets twisted, manipulated, you know, those kind of things, misrepresented. And so that's kind of one of my, you know, kind of covert missions in life, is that as you come along people and you encounter those misrepresentations, hey, let's walk that back. Let's deconstruct that, and then let's reconstruct that based on what Christianity really believes or what the Bible really teaches.
It's funny, this is going to say a lot about my character, but I watched a movie last night that had all these, I don't know what you'd call them, almost like the frat pack version of, you know, the 80s actors that we knew, like RDJ and all those people, Molly Ringwald. There's like an element of a rat pack or a frat pack that's out now with like Seth Rogen and Jonah Hill and all those guys, that kind of fraternity that they run in. They did a movie called This Is the End. And my wife and I, we've seen a lot of things. Hey, we've never seen this before. Let's try it out. Completely vulgar, but whatever. We're just watching it. It's just, you know, background din. But it's all about end times. Like, okay, the rapture happens, and they did it where all these people are beamed up out of the convenience stores where they are and out of houses and everything.
Yeah.
And they're trying to figure out what's going on. They come to the conclusion, well, hey, this is the end. Yeah. And the theology that plays throughout is that, well, hey, if you have a self-sacrificial type of bent, you still have element of hope from that first, you know, eschatology being your thing,
yeah,
that first initial 7-year period, that is where it's like, okay, you've got one more shot.
Yeah.
Make it work. And that's, it kind of plays out. It was very interesting to see for, I would have to say, you know, these guys who are probably non-believers and yeah, throwing it, making fun of it.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating concept because, again, it sounds like they certainly get a lot of things wrong.
Yeah.
But yet underlying all of that is this interest in, you know, the fact that there's a sense of we're headed towards, you know, some kind of reckoning. And what would that look like? And how could you make it right? Which, again, is a twisted version of Christianity. Their yeah, idea is we can save ourselves if we're good right during this time.
Yeah.
Versus the gospel message is totally opposite. We can't save ourselves.
Right.
God had to do that for us because of the mess that we had created.
Good luck.
And so, yeah. And so it's fascinating. So I actually find hope in even the because it gives you a jumping off point into that conversation.
It really does.
That the world is even interested in these things at all.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you can kind of say to them that, you know, I got good news for you. You don't even have to do that much.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, it's still a free gift while you're walking around.
Yeah. And there's just so much, man, you know, as you well know, you get into the world of eschatology and it brings out a lot of the crazies. But what I've found by leaning into it instead of running away from it is it's actually more beautiful, richer, and deeper than you would ever understand. The book of Revelation, for instance, at the end of the Bible, is an incredible book. It is a literary masterpiece that literally takes all of these themes and threads that have been woven through, you know, 1,500 years of biblical authors writing these things down and brings all of those threads together in a way that gives us hope, you know, about God, what God has for his people in the future of the earth.
Well, Revelation, if I'm correct, is John trying to interpret these visions that were given to him.
Right.
Right. He doesn't know what he's seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, they're symbolic of all of this that's in the Bible.
Yeah.
And so every phrase, every line, every color, every word picture, right, represents something else that's all being pulled together. And that's one of the things that gives hope, right? What John is doing, and this, a lot of people miss it, not to go preach a sermon here, but the book of Revelation is actually not even, you know, the focus isn't the end times. The focus is worship. John is in worship on the Lord's day, exiled as an old man who's spent his life serving, you know, walking alongside Jesus and serving the church. And he thinks he's put out a commission, you know, and Jesus shows up and says, let me draw back the curtain of history and give you a picture, because the church, and this is pretty relevant to some of the stuff happening in the world right now, was being deeply persecuted and suffering in that era towards the end of the first century. And so basically he says, let me show you this picture. And it's a picture of what happens, the unfolding of history, again, like a play or a drama. It's really symbolic. And in the end, Jesus wins. And so it's designed to bring hope and encouragement, not to fuel fear and speculation.
We had a gentleman on here, his name is Brad Lee, a couple weeks ago. And every time, he's got one of the bigger business podcasts out there called Dropping Bombs, and he's out of Las Vegas. Been a, I guess, a self-professed believer for the past 10 years, but I'm still searching and learning, is how he puts it. And it's funny, all of the biggest thing that always comes up in his podcasts are they will know me by my name, that particular. And he says, that one really resonates with me because it's, okay, what's his name?
Mm.
And everyone, he says, it's not Jesus. I go, okay. I don't really know how to converse that or have a conversation around that, because I don't know enough about the linguistics and how things were changed over time and translated. Yeah. I said, yeah, I understand in the beginning it was Yeshua and then God was Yahweh. And how Yeshua became Jesus, I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know how to have that conversation.
The Hebrew, right?
Right.
So which we transliterate Joshua, right, is you know, put into English as Jesus, of course. And
right.
So, yeah, but that's, yeah. And of course, the Bible's full of these depictions of God and his names, you know, and what they represent. And so,
is that a God thing that God said, okay, I have many names?
Well, in the sense of, yes, being able to identify him, but also his character and his ways, the way he reveals himself, you know. And so in Revelation, of course, Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end.
Right.
You know, and so that's the way that book opens.
Yeah, I mean, and that's highly interpreted, you know, interpretive book. Because nobody's going to know this. People will know the season and identify the season. And understandably, in the past, we could say that seasons have revealed themselves. So people thought that they were always in that season, and it turns out they weren't.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think we're in the season now?
Well, certainly. And here's one thing that's important, right? So there is a difference in the Bible. It talks about the last days and the last day. Right. And a lot of people miss that, right? Because it's just one letter. Last days is basically the era we're in since Jesus left. We are in the last days until he returns.
Right.
Now, the last day is the when last day, right? Yeah. Right. It's the big one. And as Martin Luther famously said, I live this day in light of that day. Right. So regardless of when it is, this is when, you know, a lot of people get into trouble because they begin to speculate. And you've heard and read the stories about the radio preachers and TV preachers. It's
going
to be on this day. Yeah. You know, well, a true scholar of these things knows that you know, we can be certain about something. Jesus will return. There will be a sudden visible bodily return of Christ, right? But when you get down into those particulars, you have to walk with a lot of humility. And I think that God designed it that way because Jesus himself told his disciples, right? It's not for you to know the day and the hour. What you're supposed to do is get about the business of loving me, loving people, and showing them my way. And we do know when the end will come. It says, when the gospel is preached to all nations, then the end will come. So, you know, Jesus told us that. When that'll happen, we're not sure, but we know our job is to finish the task.
A lot of people will surely agree that in the past couple of years, things seem to be quickening, ramping up.
Yeah, you know? Jesus uses the metaphor, right, of it's like labor pains. They get more intense and more frequent before the end. And I'm often involved in conversations where it's like it certainly seems that way, you know, especially in recent events, worldwide pandemics and, you know, the things taking place, earthquakes, wars, rumors of wars, all of those things. And yet, we also have to remember we live in the information age. And so,
disinformation age.
Well, true. Yeah. So, we at least are exposed to a lot more of what's happening globally than previous generations was. Right. So, again, the point is live every day like it could be tomorrow.
Right.
You know, that's the point that Jesus was making to his disciples then, and I believe to his disciples now, you know, is that if you are living life to its fullest, you are fulfilling the mission that I put you on earth for, then you're going to have no regrets whenever that moment is. But it's the, you know, we get lulled, especially the church in the West, into this kind of, you know, it's been called the sleeping giant,
right?
Because we just kind of go through the motions of what I would call religiosity and churchianity and these kind of things.
Christian culturedom, that kind of thing.
Yes, all of it. And that's what is spoofed in those movies, and that's what lampooned. And in some ways, we deserve, you know, those caricatures. But again, true Christianity is bringing people back to the heart of the Word and to Jesus.
What do you think the biggest obstacle it is for someone to actually make the decision to believe? Mm. For me, it was ego and pride and admitting the fact that I'm going to take a leap of faith into believing something that now I felt like at the time I had to back up.
Yeah. Well, C.S. Lewis calls pride the great sin.
Right.
Because you could argue that all other
intellectualism,
sins,
you know.
Yeah, are variants, right, on that one. And you can argue that, I mean, you know, since pre-time, I mean, Satan's fall, right, was due to his pride, his rebellion against God. So I think in a way that's everybody's hang up. Now how it manifests itself is differently.
Yeah.
You know, for some people it's, you know, they're going to choose, as in the famous parable of the prodigal son, I'm going to go the way of the prodigal. I'm going to rebel. I'm going to do everything my own way. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to enjoy life. But at some point that quits working for you.
That was me.
And you hit rock bottom.
Yeah.
And you say, there's got to be more to life than this. This isn't working. On the other hand, there's the older brother in the story who he tries the path of basically religion. I'm going to keep the father happy. I'm going to do everything I'm supposed to do. But then when the younger brother comes home, is accepted back by the father, he gets hacked. Why? Because he was trying to control the father by playing by the rules. And basically that's the story of humanity. We're all one of those two people, or we've been both, and we try both. For a while, we're going to try to be good and follow the rules, and then we can't do that, so screw it all, and we're going to, you know, we're going to go wild, and we're going to try to do it our own way. And then we're like, oh, no, we got to come back. And so, you know, again, the gospel teaches us that we can't save ourselves, that we have to be rescued by what God has done through the Son, Jesus Christ.
You know, it's funny, and in the element of Jesus, I go back to the gospels. I like reading those over and seeing what he said. When the woman was caught in adultery and he saves her, what does he say to her as he walks away? Is go and sin no more. Mm-hmm. Don't you think he was saying that kind of like, go and sin no more. Good luck. I mean, because you're gonna do it. I mean, your mere existence is somewhat sinful.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and Paul talks about that in the book of Romans. He talks about the fact, and obviously Paul, you know, radically saved, you know, had been a Jew among Jews, and now he's, you know, the guy. He's planting churches, writing books of the Bible. And he says, the reality is, man, I know what I ought to do, but I don't want to do it, you know? And he struggles with that. So yes, I think every believer still struggles with what we call the old nature, our old self, our old habits, you know?
But backsliding?
That's the old preacher term for it. That's right. But, you know, in that story, I think you also think about the woman, and she realizes, like, Jesus has literally just saved her life.
Yeah.
And so I think that calling, right, to say, go and sin no more. In other words, don't let your sin define who you are any longer. You know, that's a calling to a different way of life. No. And when you've been transformed, when you've truly been rescued, then, you know, what you used to want is not attractive to you anymore. Right. That old way of life, you know, that's not necessary anymore. I can find a new way of life now.
Not easier said for women than guys. You got that damn biological drive that we have that just, you know, procreate. And it's funny because somebody had pointed out to me that even when, like, I tell people all the time that, look, the nature of sin, when we get down to the bottom of it, I said, when Jesus was talking about go and sin no more, I said, you do realize that adultery in his eyes is checking out another woman's rump and going, damn, that's adultery, pal.
Sermon on the Mount, if you let your mind go there.
Yeah.
And that was, again, what was radical about Jesus' teaching. You know, again, back to this idea of religiosity. Yeah. A lot of people think of religion, right, is not just breaking the rules.
Using it as a weapon.
Right. And Jesus is saying, no, it's what's in your heart that matters.
But I mean, that's the bug. He says, that's my point, though, is that, look, this is why you need me. You can't do this.
That's right. That's
you
right.
Cannot Nobody can do this.
And again, you can fool everybody.
Right.
And we certainly have seen that. You know, there's generations of hypocritical Christians, which, interestingly enough, Jesus gave us the name hypocrite.
Right.
And so.
Well, I've heard the adopted version of hypocristian before.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, my kids come home with that. And it certainly spurns conversation, especially with them being in public school. I mean, around here in the community, you being a part of it for the past 20 years, have you seen an increase in skeptics, intellectual, you know, people that are calling, you know, having these conversations about faith? More so, you know, the tip of the spear kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think on a general cultural level, right, there has been a drift, you know, but there's always a silver lining to that too, because there are always people, as I mentioned earlier, who are searching for more. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the realities. I think part of the reason that the world is frustrated with Christians, so to speak, is because we, unfortunately, have a dangerous tendency to want to look and act just like them more than we do distinct and set apart. And so they're actually looking for us to be different. They're looking for a different way. They're looking for a different story, a different narrative by which to build and understand their lives.
Right.
And so that's, you know, when the Bible uses this word, you know, holy, right? That's what it means to be set apart, to be different. And so certainly we are in the world. We're not of the world, you know? And so that doesn't mean that we don't interact with people, that kind of stuff. We don't set ourselves apart. But the way we think, the way we interact, the way we live our lives, the mission, you know, that we're on, all of those things should be distinct and different enough that people around us, even if they don't know we're Christians, should say, there's something different about that guy.
Yeah. They say, yeah, there's something about him. And that's what they all said about Jesus when he was walking, his mission. And I used to say back, I used to go to the Bridge and have, I used to go every Sunday with my kids. You know, we weren't really on board, my wife and I, with the whole going to church thing together. I haven't been to church in years at this point. So that's what I mean, that backsliding kind of happens. My thing is, on Friday mornings, a buddy of mine and I get together and we have a Bible study every week, and it kind of keeps me in the know of things. And I find myself having more and more conversations about apologetics and the data of Christ and his ministry back in the day with a lot of people from California, from Wisconsin, from all different parts of the country that are now coming here.
I was going to say, and they are coming here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Out of, you know, new people at the church, out of every 10, 7 is from California. Really? 2 of them are from Chicago, and 1 of them is from somewhere else.
Are they drastically different, or are they still like-minded to you guys?
I mean,
to us?
There's some cultural differences, but no, I think at least the influx here that we have seen, you know, is people who are looking, they're finally to a point that they're saying, for a host of reasons, you know, government overreach, economics, we need to get out. We need a new start.
So maybe that's what's building up the past 50, 60, 70 years here in the South, the buckle of the Bible Belt was this, okay, get ready. I'm going to be sending them to you.
Yeah. It's changing, let me tell you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but you're getting a lot of people. That's why I'm wondering if the frequency of those conversations is happening where a lot of skeptics, cynics, doubters are coming and just, you know. Because, I mean, I have these conversations where, well, you know, those Christians, they don't exactly. I said, well, that's the problem, is that you're not looking towards the right thing. They're flawed people.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And that's you know, again, a stereotype that, you know, Christians are somehow perfect or whatever. And yes, we should be striving to be more and more like Christ.
Yeah.
But the reality is the message of Christianity is don't look at people. It's look at Christ himself.
Right.
You know, look at what Jesus did. Look at who he said he is. And because we all have to confess our need and dependence on him.
Now, one of the things I've been hearing, a lot of the conversations I've been having, is that, you know, in the end, we're going to be okay.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know that I want to go with the probably, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, it's hey, you could be right, but what if you're wrong?
Yeah.
You know, and what Brad Lee had said is that, well, I just don't believe that a God is going to punish people for eternity. I mean, why would you do that to one of your children? And I'm going, well, is it us doing it, or is it him? I mean, it's
well, and that's my point precisely. Yeah. is that if you really lean into what the Bible teaches, you teach, right, that God gives us an opportunity, and we've rejected that. And so if you don't want to have a relationship with God now, why would you want to be with him forever?
Right.
And so at some point, God in essence says, have it your way, you know.
Yeah.
And that's really what that story is more about. And yes, again, it's been caricatured and lampooned, you know, as all of this, you know, but you know, the reality is that you know, people choose that. They choose to reject God.
What they don't realize is, I said, you do realize that of the notion of hell and damnation, Jesus was the one who spoke the most about it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so whenever I have these conversations with people that, you know, it's oddly enough, one of the people started the conversation by, we had, you know, exclaimed about something, and she said, you know, Jesus, you know, she used it in vain.
Sure.
And I said, why don't you just say Prophet Muhammad?
Hmm.
She goes, well, that would be offensive. And I go, and the other way isn't?
Right.
Well, okay. What do you mean? And we got into the whole thing. I said, look, I don't really believe he was. I said, okay, who he said he was. Do you believe he existed? Let's start there.
Yeah.
Just start there.
Yeah.
Simple. Well, yeah, he existed. He had to have existed. There's way too many things. Okay, terrific.
Yeah.
Great. Glad you said that. Let's take that one step further.
Yeah.
Did he say and do the things he said and did?
Hmm.
Okay. Yes or no? Well, I don't know. Okay, great. And then...
Let's talk about that. Yeah. Right. Apologetics 101.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Well, you're building a bridge. You're establishing a common ground. And that's what you find so often happens. And that's why those personal conversations are important. Because we find ourselves culturally talking past one another, you know.
Or having pointless Facebook conversations.
And that is very true. And now we know it's all an echo chamber, and we're just all talking to people who think and act like us.
Yeah. The biggest thing people can do is get in front of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It changes.
Because you're not going to say the things that you would say behind a keyboard.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Well, and it's part of why, you know, I would say often, one of my favorite verses in the Bible is John 1:14, which says, the word became flesh, and my favorite translation says, and moved into the neighborhood.
Really?
You know, yeah. Yeah. I mean, God could have sent his message, right? By YouTube. He could have, you know, done it, you know, written it in the sky. He could have done it any way he chose, but he chose to send it in a person.
Yeah.
And that means by its very nature, ministry is incarnational. It's person to person. And it's part of why this last 18 months or so has been such a challenge for churches, you know, with COVID and, you know, distancing and those kind of things, because there is something inherently personal about sitting across from somebody face to face.
Yeah.
About giving someone a hug, about, you know, sharing a meal with them, that is key, a crucial conduit for the gospel.
I know people that it's taken its toll. I mean, not just because of maybe getting the virus, mm-hmm. but just the whole notion that they thrived on human contact.
Absolutely.
You know, physical contact, having hugs, and they hold up for, well, I was told to stay home, so I'm staying home.
Yeah.
You know, shack up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's lots of stories out there. I'm friends with a lot of guys in the Spring Hill PD, and so, you know, 33% increase in domestic violence.
Oh, really?
You know, because, man, people just being at home and they just got into it with each other. You know, depression, suicide rates among teenagers skyrocketed nationwide. Right. You know, because again, we're hardwired to some degree for relationships. Some of us more. We're very social people. We can have a lot of relationships. Some of us less. But we all need healthy relationships for human flourishing.
We weren't designed to be under a roof all the time.
No.
You got to get out and get some vitamin D.
Not designed for isolation.
Right. And it's funny because one of the things I talk about, I don't know if you listened in the past episodes, I bring up this concept called pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, I think so. Give me a little context.
It's basically a book that was written by a guy who came up, and he's an evangelical Christian. He's got an agency called the Wizard Academy, or okay. Wizards of Ads is what he calls himself. And he was kind of a radio copywriter, influencer, taught us guys in radio how to write better ads for our clients. And he had a trilogy of books called The Wizard of Ads. And that then led to a school down in Austin called the Wizard Academy, which is incredible. You should actually go if you get a chance.
Yeah.
Very cerebral stuff. Great guy, Roy H. Williams. But he and another co-author named Michael Drew wrote a book called Pendulum. I'm trying to think of the actual slug line, but it's basically talking about how, hey, at one point in time, what we were saying about our clients and the copy we were writing, what was working last year isn't working anymore.
Mm.
What happened?
Mm-hmm.
What happened to culture? What's making people tick that all of a sudden this isn't working anymore?
Yeah.
That led them to, they called it the 40-year pendulum.
Okay.
And it's based off of, there's another book called Generations.
Mm-hmm.
They break it down into four 20-year groups,
yeah.
Right? So they said, actually, based on their information, we actually see it as like a 40-year pendulum,
mm-hmm.
where we go from a me-centered society
mm-hmm.
to a we-centered society.
Yep.
And we are actually right now, they call the we-centered society part of the pendulum, the zenith, the darkest part of the pendulum.
Hmm.
It happens every 80 years like clockwork.
Fascinating.
Every 80 years, things just get really uncertain, really dark. There's conflict. There's cataclysms, things of that nature. So if you draw back...
We're talking World War II.
World War II and before that,
yeah.
Civil War.
Yeah.
Before that, Revolutionary War.
Fascinating.
It's mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the we is a very community type of mindset. And typically on both ends of the pendulum is when we have taken a good thing too far. So at the tipping point is when it feels fresh.
Yeah.
It feels good as we're going on the upswing.
Yeah. Well, and that's fascinating. Even back to Revelation, right? Points out the cycles of history. I mean, you know, and that there are patterns and there are trends. And it's certainly true that we tend to, and I see this even in the church. Yeah. We have an intergenerational church. So you have senior adults. And just think about what our senior adults, our 70 and 80 year olds, what they have experienced, to your point,
right.
in their own lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, born post-World War II, you know, and just, you know, putting men on the moon, and now they're carrying around a phone in their pocket with more computing power than the Apollo 13 spacecraft.
With the entire world's knowledge on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so you think about what they've experienced, and then I watch the reaction of the generations to each other within the church.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the real interesting just surface-level trends right now is young people love the old-school music, the hymns. You know,
really?
the more old school. Yeah, because you react. You know, you had that generation that loved a certain style of music, and then you have their parents come along and they want everything to be seeker driven and, you know, these kind of things. Now, they don't want it played like a funeral march, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But they love the fact that it seems timeless. It seems rooted in something deeper. There's some history to it. You know, these songs have stood the test of time, when a lot of the stuff they're, you know, it's on Christian radio is going to be here today, gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
Even to your point about, you know, a lot of the modern worship stuff is me, singing to God about my emotions and my feelings, you know, versus songs that really talk about the character and nature of God, that have good theology
community.
Embedded in them. Yeah, community sense. And that's another trend we see. When we launched Station Hill, do you know the very first thing, just informally, that people said they wanted to bring back? The church potluck.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was so funny. You know, so what are the trendy new things you do when you're launching a church, young pastor? Well, we're going to sing hymns and we're going to have church potlucks, because that sense of community, you know, coming together, fellowshipping around a meal, you know, enjoying those connections. And again, as we mentioned earlier, Spring Hill, you've got everybody who had been uprooted and come here. So a lot of them don't have extended family near, you know. Now their moms and dads have followed them, a lot of them, so they can be near the grandkids now. You know, 10, 15 years later, but people are looking for those meaningful relationships.
Spring Hill was known, and Josh Howerton actually had said this to me. He says Spring Hill is actually known as one of the most loneliest towns out there.
Yeah.
One of the loneliest towns.
Yeah.
Because
we see it all the time.
Yeah.
Because people walk in the doors of the church. They don't know anything about the church. They're just like, I'm looking to connect. They'll say, right. I'm looking for a friend. And again, a lot of times young families move here and they know it's a good place to raise kids, but grandma and grandpa are back in California or Texas or Chicago or wherever. So a lot of people show up at our church and they're saying, we're looking at for a church with, I've been told this, with some gray hairs in it.
Right.
Because we basically need some surrogate grandmas and grandpas right. to come around us. And so that's one of the beautiful things that happens in church is that we call each other brother and sister for a reason. Like we create community, you know, in the environment for that to take place and meaningful relationships happen.
Going back to what you were saying about the octogenarians and things of that nature, we're talking about the 80-year swing from a we to a we, because basically the book asserts that we're going to live through 1943 all over again in 2023. That's on the threes, oddly enough, is when things typically
happen. The
tipping points and the zeniths and things of that nature. Our upswing began in 2003. We're going to zenith in 2023 with whatever happened in the early 40s is going to start playing out again. How people deal with each other, listen to the lyrical content of popular music back then, what was popular in movies, things of that nature. I believe, and this is going to sound completely horrible, and I've been saying it for the past 2 weeks. I said, you know, we almost could use a good war. You know, that's unfortunately what kind of resets a lot of this. And gets us heading back down are those cataclysms that happen at the darkest part of a we. And they seem to happen every 80 years.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is interesting because what does war do?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it resets everything.
It does.
And know why we forget about it? Why we relive history over and over again? Because we can read about it all we want.
Yeah. I was a history teacher before I got in ministry. Right. So those who don't know the past are doomed to repeat it.
But even if you know the past, you're doomed to repeat it. You know why? We don't know what it felt like.
Yeah.
We have no idea how intrinsic it was, even for our parents. Our grandparents barely lived through World War II. They were children.
Yeah.
Okay, the people who are now being able to talk about the Holocaust were children at the time.
Yeah.
They know they have the tattoo, but gosh, they were 4 or 5 years old. What they remember?
Right.
Their long-term memory hasn't really been formed.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Their parents remember.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are, if they're still alive, looking at what's happening, going, this is all too familiar.
Well, that's why in the Bible, over and over again, God tells Israel, remember what I did when I brought you out of slavery in Egypt. Remember, remember, remember. It's there over and over because we forget. And like you said, if we don't experience it personally, a lot of times it's hard for us to really appreciate it.
Right.
And so that's a pretty fascinating theory. To go there for a second, I've heard this many times.
Yeah.
Well, politically, we are so divided. What could ever bring us back together again?
You know? War.
And sadly enough, you know, but you don't want it to come to that
because
you know that, you know, millions of lives are going to be affected, that, you know, people are going to die, those kind of things. But yet again, human nature is so stubborn and so broken that we do tend to fall into the same patterns. I mean, it's why in Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, there's nothing new under the sun.
Oh my gosh, dude, that's actually quoted in the book.
Yeah.
What is new is what is old is new again.
Yeah.
And there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, if you peel it down, right, to its essence, these same issues have been with us, right, since Adam and Eve.
Because we're Garden human.
Yep, and they're going to continue to be that way.
For those people who'd actually say, we've never seen it like this before, I'm like, oh, yeah, we have.
Yeah.
This is called the Civil War.
Yeah.
We were very divided then.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, that was the bloodiest war in U.S. history. And it has the biggest body count.
Yeah. One of my little pet peeves during the pandemic has been unprecedented times. I was like, really? Unprecedented?
No. I'm sure you show the Black Plague was just as bad, if not worse.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, speaking of Christianity, part of why Christianity grew so quickly was they think now it's smallpox, but there was a disease that in the 3rd century wiped out 1/3 of the Roman Empire. Like a third of all people died.
Yeah.
And Christians were the only people willing to get involved because they knew where they were going. So, you know, they started caring for the poor, the sick. As a matter of fact, even one of the pagan Roman emperors was like, the Christians are caring for our poor, not just their poor, our sick, not just their, they're putting us to shame.
Yeah.
And that's part of why the reason that Christianity exploded in those early centuries, right? From this little, you know, colloquial, you know, kind of hard to define, hard to understand movement of people who followed Jesus to a worldwide phenomena was because they were willing to get involved and do the things the rest of the world was not.
Well, also, there's an element of God kind of coming out into all these scenarios, especially now what we're going through. And I had this conversation the other day. I said, if you really bake it down, what are we really afraid of here? Okay. And I, the person I was talking to, she kind of raised an eyebrow and she looked at me and I said, what are we really afraid of here? I said, this is, you know, getting sick, going through challenges and troubles and turmoil and things of that nature. I said, the ultimate thing we're afraid of is death. All right. Death for us, death for our loved ones, death for children. We don't want to see death. Okay. We feel like, you know, for people over 70 or into 80 years old, yeah, you know, you lived your life. Death is probably, it's knocking on your door. Okay. Not for me though, because I'm still 40 is something or 50, you know, I got time left. Not really. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point is God's telling you, no, it could be tomorrow, pal.
That's right.
Okay. You need to start taking this seriously. What are you going to do? Because that's where your faith ends is death. Then what? Right.
Well, you find out what your faith really is. Right. That's the fulfillment.
And it's in that book is very, it's very poignant when you really kind of expand out all those concepts over the, that 80 year generation, because even like to your point before, we like to really hardline our positions, you know, on Facebook, I believe this, you know, all you see it going on all around you. And it seems like we're so divided, but I tell people all the time, I said, there's always hope. There's always hope. I said, even the guys who were in the foxholes and the trenches in World War II.
Yeah.
And it's evidenced in, if you watch Band of Brothers, right? At the beginning of every episode, they have the actual guys who were in the war that the characters are based off of talking about their experiences. And it really dawned on me, and it kind of gave me a little pat on the back that my, what I've been saying, that how that intrinsic history that we forgot, that we've never been able to feel, these guys felt, okay? And they got to the point in the war of like, okay, why are we doing this again? I forgot. I can't remember why we're fighting. This guy I'm firing at, I might like him. He may like to fish and hunt like I do. He may like whittling wood, okay, like I do. Why am I killing him again? And doesn't that always kind of get to that point where people, even in long-term fights, I know I'm mad at him. Why? I don't remember.
Yeah.
I'm just mad.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, the why is always the pressing question.
Right.
And as a leader, as a general, as a whatever, if you can't keep the why before your people, right, then you're doomed to fail.
Right. Right. The flame sparked, so to speak. Well, with that being said, I know we're having a great conversation. Yeah. I'm having a lot of fun. What's your problem? I would imagine it's quite varied over the past 18 months.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are so, when you asked me that question, there are so many ways that we could go. But I think, you know, adapting to change, that's what COVID revealed. As I've shared with many churches and our people and people that I interact with, COVID-19 didn't really change anything.
Yeah.
But it accelerated the change rate that was already in place. And that's what we saw. So if your organization was healthy, if your business was healthy, well, it got stronger in some ways, you know, because it forced us to focus on, you know, kind of core principles.
Biggest word out of that year was pivot.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But if you were unhealthy, right, then it revealed, you know, where those tensions were. And so one of the, you know, being a history guy, one of my favorite metaphors, and there's actually a great book on leadership change about it called Canoeing the Mountains. And it's about the Lewis and Clark expedition. And it's about how they, you know, as they're expanding and exploring the Louisiana Purchase, they were expert canoers. And they were sure when they got to the Continental Divide that they were going to get there and they were going to see a river taking them nice and smoothly all the way down to the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
Instead, they discovered what? The Rocky Mountains.
Yeah, there's more mountains after
exactly this. And so they had to pivot to use last year's favorite word, right? And they had to learn as expert canoers how to trek the mountains. They had to learn how to build partnerships with the natives who live there in order to just be able to survive. And it is such a great understanding for us, I think, in the time we're in, whether you're in the church, whether you're in a business, whether you're trying to lead a community, because of the pace of change, you have to be ready. And there's this really interesting kind of like, imagine a Venn diagram with three overlapping things that help you be able to navigate that. One is what they call the on the map skill set.
Right.
This is your competence. This is you do what you do and you do it well, right? That's key. then the other circle would have the word trust in it. And that's your relational equity. That's that people know you by reputation. They trust you. They believe that you can lead them to where they need to go. But the third one, and this is what we struggle with in the church and others, this is what we would call the off the map skill set. This is when now we're off the map, right? Lewis and Clark, we're off the map. We got to figure out how to do something we're not good at historically and we've never done before. We know what we're good at, right? Canoeing and exploring. We built trust with our team, but now we have to take that team and we have to adapt.
Right.
And so adaptive capacity and you know, being able to adapt as a leader is, I think, the key to being successful in this era.
So how have you done?
It's always interesting. In some ways good, in other ways not. As I said earlier, I think COVID revealed where we had strength and where we didn't. One example, of course, was as a church, you're very used to gathering. So all of a sudden, churches who, you know, we had an online presence, but it wasn't very good.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, as the joke went, you know, COVID-19 came and we were all televangelists overnight.
Right.
And so that's a different medium mm-hmm. when, you know, you're used to being in a room with people and, you know, our tradition, people aren't super demonstrative. There's not a lot of, you know, hand raising and shouting and clapping and, you know, but you can read if people are with you in the room. Yeah. Well, now you're looking into a camera. You know, an inanimate object, and you're having to try to teach truth, and you're trying to have to communicate to people who are on the other side of that lens. So, you know, it challenged us, I think, to get better in some key and important ways, especially when you think about reaching people.
Yeah.
And so one of the remarkable things that's happened now is we have people who are tuning in from all over the country and even all over the world.
Oh, wow.
Because of they, you know, somebody was connected to our church. Hey, check this one out online, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of churches have a similar story. So that's just one simple example. Another thing that we've been emphasizing for years in our church is that, you know, what we do with parents and children in a young community full of young families is incredibly important. But we can't train your kid and all they need to know about the Bible in an hour or two a week. Right. And by the way, it's not even really that much a week. You know, they got a ball game, you got to go to grandma's house. So it's a couple hours a month, you know, to spiritually train the next generation. And so we discovered, you know, that we had been talking about this for a long time, but all of a sudden it was our parents at home watching church online with their kids and having to teach their kids the Bible. You know, some of our parents did really well. Others, quite frankly, were transparent and they struggled. But that's given us an opportunity to go back and equip them.
Nice. Very cool. I mean, and it's, I'm sure there's still challenges that are coming out because now you're meeting back in person.
Right.
How's the whole, I mean, do you have sects of people who are pro-vaccine, anti-vaccine? Sure. You're dealing with that?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's just like every culture. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has an idea about it. What we've tried to do as a church is we've tried to be really balanced on the issue, which means we have people who think we've not done enough, and there's people out there who think we've done too much.
Yeah.
But one of the things I told our people early on, the church is for everybody. Therefore, it's not going to be ideal for anybody, you know, for some time, because we've all got to show each other grace. We've all, you know, and that's been my point about masks, vaccines, all of these things. You don't know somebody else's story.
Yeah.
So they may be healthy, but they may have parents they're taking care of who are ill. You know, right. They may have comorbidities that you weren't aware of, health conditions, those kind of things. And so, you know, one of the most encouraging things I've seen is that people have come back to church. They get this desire for community and face-to-face relationship. But of course, one of the discouraging things that you see is those same people who sit together in church and sing are on social media trying to blast each other because of their opinions about some of these things that divide. And so we have to be really careful in culture, but in the church specifically, about what we allow to divide us. And so that calling, right, to unity, like, hey, let's be on the same page. Not uniformity. We don't all have to think the same, act the same, but unity, that we're in this together. That's a key part of the Christian faith and the Christian message.
One of the things they say in that Pendulum book is very biblical. In that dark time, mm-hmm. the best way to combat the darkness is massive amounts of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to understand and articulate your antagonist's point of view better than they can.
That's good.
Will really go a long way.
Yeah, we say it this way. One of our values as a church, seek to understand more than to be understood.
Right.
You know, so when you start from that posture, one of my favorite little phrases as a pastor is simply this: help me understand.
John Warner uses that phrase all the time.
Well, there you go. Yeah. He might have heard it from somebody, but it's just true. It just, you know, because what that does is it puts me, you know, and it just puts me in a position where I want to learn. Okay, well, help explain that perspective to me.
Right. Well, you're being, I call it be them centric,
you know, good.
In sales and selling.
Yeah.
We've got Kyle in the other room who's been taking on the charge of selling the Octave product and other lighting products within our fold here at Big Dot. And I've been teaching him everything. Everything I learned in the car business was all about them. Okay. Yeah. It is not about you. You know,
which it's, the Christian message, right?
Right.
It's not about
it's
you.
It's not about you. I mean, in Doctor Strange, you a big Marvel fan?
I've seen the movie.
You've seen the movie. There's a very poignant line when he's standing, the Ancient One is seeing the vision that she can't get past. She's like, Steven, you're missing the point. What is the point? It's not about you. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I'm like, amen.
Yeah.
You know, and it's tough to for a lot of people to see past that.
Yeah.
You know, there are people getting to the Facebook arguments and you see the comment sections, this tailspin.
Yeah.
And people put the popcorn memes up, and those are the people that realize, well, here we go.
Yeah.
I've got my entertainment for the day.
Yeah, and it just creates so much sideways energy,
right?
You know, that could be used towards building a healthy relationship versus, you know, trying to tear one down.
I challenged one person one day, and I believe, dude, I was the guy back in the day that would take people on and you know, stir the pot.
You had
and everything.
The energy.
Right. And eventually you go, I can't control this. Why am I getting myself so worked up? It doesn't, what am I getting out of this? Nothing.
Yeah.
It does not help my life.
Well, in your illustration earlier about, you know, the guy in World War II, you know, why am I shooting this guy? You get to a point where you realize, what does this really do for him?
Yeah.
What does this do for me?
Right.
You know?
And I asked somebody who was popularly divisive on, you know, within our town here. I mean, there are a number of people who do that. But this one particular person, I said, you know, she started going into her thing, and I said, what do you get out of this? Well, what do you mean? I said, well, I know what you're doing. I used to do it. What is it that you, what's in this for you?
Yeah, I said, what's the thing behind the thing?
Yeah. Okay. What are you getting out of this? Mm-hmm. Is it a rise? Is it to feel better about yourself? Is it to feel like you're right? Well, I just want to plant seeds. Seeds of what?
Want
to change people's mind.
Thorn bushes.
Yeah.
Idea.
I said, okay, you're changing people's mind, but not about what you're talking about. It's about you. That's basically what I tell people.
Yeah.
What is it? The Carnegie quote, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still.
Mm.
And it's like, you can't just hammer them.
Yeah.
You got to just have understanding, loving. I said, they're going to know you by their fruits, by your fruits.
Yeah.
And you got to have these loving conversations at the end of the day. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you've got to meet people where they're at. And again, that doesn't mean you don't speak the truth or you don't share what you believe. But, you know, there's this key verse in Ephesians, and it's talking about, again, unity in the church, where Paul says, speak the truth in love.
Right.
And that is, it's like brilliant in its simplicity.
Doesn't mean it has to be a pretty conversation.
No, no. Right. And it doesn't mean it's an easy one. As a matter, you know, because I would argue, right? There's people who are all about truth and we're going to pound them with the truth, right? But they don't, to your point, they don't really genuinely care about these people. There's no empathy. There's no love. On the other hand, some people say, oh, I just want to love everybody. But I'll argue, you're not loving people well if you don't love them enough to tell them the truth.
Right.
Because the truth is often what they need. But you have to have the relational equity. You know, you have to build the bridge. You have to take the time to demonstrate that you really care about the person in order for transformation to take place.
And understanding you always don't have to have the answers.
That's right. You know? Humility.
And that's, yeah.
And, you know, well, and that's another thing about our world today is now all of a sudden we got to be experts on everything.
Right.
And it's so funny because I get this as a pastor because I don't post a lot on social media.
Right.
You know why? Because I'm not an expert on, you know, pandemics.
And you don't want to get involved with
it. I'm not an expert on global politics. I'm not an expert on, you know, and again, it's just, there's people who expect you now, you know, in the news cycle to be able to quote on everything. And if you don't, well, then you don't care, which couldn't be farther from the truth.
There's we've had some employees in the past that have worked for me that will have different conflicts within our organization. We try to navigate them the best we can.
Sure.
And one of them decided to go on social media on Instagram and vague book,
right?
You know, the scenario that I knew she was talking about.
Yeah,
so I call her up, and I'm often wondering if this is a scenario you find yourself in that you want to do. Because I'm built like, okay, look, why did you put that up?
Right.
And I asked, well, just, do you feel better?
Yeah.
You feel better? Well, I don't know. I said, let's take it down. What's the point of doing that? To let everybody know that you're vaguely mad about something? Well, I don't know. I said, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Talk to the person you have a problem with.
Yep.
And try and work it out. I said, because guess what? This gets back to them. Guess who has to deal with it? Me.
That's right. That's okay. Right. Well, again, that's biblical. Jesus said, if you got a problem with a brother, you take it to him, right? You don't go talk about him. You take it to him. There's so much wisdom in that.
There is. And it's an onion, you know, every time you read it. But do you ever find yourself in those scenarios where you see stuff online or for some reason you're in, you know, you just want to grab a person and be like, dude.
Oh, sure.
Come on. Do you do that?
I have. Oh, yeah.
Do you?
Again, so, you know, you pray for wisdom. And yes, I mean, there are times you do, and there's times that you don't. Or there's, again, it's relational, it's pastoral. Yeah. And so you have to pray for wisdom of what's the best approach? Because again, the goal there is either reconciliation or to help somebody get more whole, more healthy, spiritually, emotionally, you know.
Not to be nice, though. I mean, you feel like you have to be nice, and you know, there's a loving aspect to it.
Yeah.
But there's got to be tact and strategy behind
absolutely
what you do.
Yeah. I think being nice is kind of a trap, you know, in a sense, if you're trying to always be nice.
Especially amongst young pastors. They want to win people over by charisma and energy and stuff. So
yeah.
Do you think that pastors should be, what's the minimum age? Should it be like the age of the president leading a church?
Man, that's an interesting question. And, you know, I don't know. I do know, you know, I appreciate, all I know can, you know, speak to is my own journey. I spent 13 years as kind of youth pastor, associate pastor, learning the ropes, so to speak, before I stepped into a pastoral role as kind of more the lead guy. And so I, looking back, I appreciate it. Matter of fact, I had a great conversation with the pastor I grew up under, who I had an opportunity very young, I was like 24, to take a senior pastor position at a church. And I had these other opportunities as well. And he just said, because I know it sounds exciting to be the guy, to be in charge, to, you know, lead the team, all those things. But he goes, I tell you this, I became a pastor at 18 of a little country Baptist church. Yeah. And he said, every mistake I had to make, I made as the pastor, and it affected the whole church.
Right.
So there's real wisdom in leading under before you lead over. And so I took that to heart, you know, and so, you know, I think everybody's journey again is different based on their gifting, their calling, the opportunity, assignment, those kind of things. But I do think there is something to be said for wisdom. As a matter of fact, the New Testament calls the leaders of the church elders, you know, and that's out of the long tradition of the Old Testament. But there's something to be said for wisdom. Now, again, it doesn't put an age prescription, and wisely so, because some have a lot of wisdom at a younger age. And you've probably been around them. There's some 26-year-olds who might as well be 80 with the way that they think. And
old souls.
Yeah, old souls, you know. But on the flip side, I know some older men who are very immature in their temperament, in their, you know,
I'm probably going to be one of them.
Those kind of things. So, you know, so it's a great question. I think it has more to do with what I'd call spiritual age or spiritual maturity than it does physical age.
What is the pathway of wisdom? Have you heard that adage where mistakes lead to experience and experience leads to wisdom? Is that how it goes?
Something along those lines. Like that, yeah, but it's true.
It is very true.
It's hard to replace.
I've been using a lot of the words, the phrasings of like life experience, especially talking to some of the younger staff here. Of guys, you don't know this stuff until you have life. You got some miles under your belt.
Yep.
You know, and you know you can have these conversations. I said, you know, to Kyle, he's struggling with nerves and having a gift of gab on the phone. I said, for some people, it just comes naturally. I said, when I got into radio, the midday person, she talked about the notion of having a gift of gab. And I was in my mid-20s. I'm going, do I have that? I don't know if I have that. Am I going to be good at this?
Yeah.
You know, and have the gift of gab on radio. Yeah. I mean, you watch me now doing my thing. One might assume I have it. But back in the 20s, I didn't. I don't know.
Well, same thing with me in preaching.
Yeah.
You know, a big part of what I do, of course, is communication. And, you know, people are, you know, how do you do that? How do you get it? Well, I tell them, high school speech class, I would throw up before I gave a speech.
Right.
I would be that nervous.
Yeah.
But along the way, somebody said, hey, you're a pretty good teacher, you know? And then to your point about the gift of gab, you have a gift. There's a seed of it, so to speak. There's a kernel of that. And then people speak into it. I believe that God shapes it in you. And you also have to do the work. I call it grit, right? That's our part. Grace is God's part, but grit is our part. We do our part to develop those skills.
Yeah.
And so over time, that gift grows and it develops. And to your point, to the point that where it bears fruit.
At the point you are now, how do you know and what gives you the most satisfaction that you're on the right path, that you feel like you're doing the right thing, that what you're speaking about and doing has an impact? What sticks out in your mind, yeah, action-wise, or something said to you at all that you filed away?
Yeah, I think as a pastor, you always appreciate, hey, pastor, thank you for this message, or hey, the way you ministered, you know, your church ministered to our family, you know, meant a lot, that kind of thing. But when you see it in action, when you see people getting it and living it out, because that's the essence of Christianity, right? It's disciples who multiply disciples.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus started with a handful of nobodies. I mean, they called themselves ordinary unschooled men in the book of Acts, right? That's what they were called. And so, you know, just everyday guys from different walks of life, but his whole strategy was to pour into these guys, and these guys change others. So when you see others who get it, and they begin, you know, sharing their faith with others, they begin leading others, they begin serving others, when you see it, that's when you know it's taken root. And that's the greatest joy I have. So I've got, you know, young guys who are now pastors who, you know, were in my youth group. We've got families in our church who said, you know what, I don't want to just sell out to the American dream. I want to go make a difference in Nepal or in Haiti or in, you know, these parts of the world. You know, that's the most encouraging thing to me.
It's funny because I even believe that Jesus showed that it's okay to be frustrated.
Oh, sure.
Because you ever get to the point where even at the Last Supper where they're like, so what is it you wanted us to do again? Right?
Yeah.
And you can hear him just going, oh, guys.
Yeah.
You've spent the last 3 years with me.
Yeah.
If you haven't gotten what I've been telling you by now, just love your God as much as you possibly can.
Well, that whole scene with Peter, to your point, at the Last Supper, you know, where he's like, you're not going to wash my feet. You're not going to. And Jesus is like, Peter, I got to wash your feet. Peter's like, no, you're not going to do it. And you know, and then, you know, Peter's finally like, okay, well then give me a whole bath. And Jesus is like, nope, just your feet, Peter. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of, again, total reverence, respect, as you know, I have a high view of scripture, but there's a lot of understated humor, especially in the interactions with Jesus and the disciples.
And a lot of people, when they think about the Bible, they don't even think that's in there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's there.
They don't realize how terribly it's written, right? Because, I mean, the Bible is actually very, it's not realistically prose fiction written.
Yeah. So, well, one of the ways you know it's authentic, right? Koine Greek. Yeah. So it's written in the common language. It wasn't written in the classical Greek. But what it's cool to me is you see the personality of the authors.
Yeah.
So John Mark, written mostly from Peter's perspective, very to the point, very, you know, but Luke was a doctor, a Gentile physician.
Yeah.
And so his Greek is much more refined. So even in the writing, you see the authenticity and the character of, you know, how God used the personalities of each of these men to bring about, you know, the stories of Jesus and his teachings that we have about to this day.
Well, I'm going to say, as we wrap up here, and we will wrap up because I know we're running out of time. I've been bringing this question into the fold with every one of my guests, or at least trying to.
Sure.
We've got a selection of different relics in the room that are Marvel-based.
Okay.
And we're going to take a picture with one of them for the thumbnail at the end of the podcast. I'm going to guess you're going to be a Stormbreaker axe guy. Am I right? What are you going to pick?
Close, but over your shoulder is Captain America's shield.
The shield is popular.
And my son, right, 13 years old, like, you know, Dad, what's your favorite all the time? So, you know, you said I'm into the Marvel movies. I'm 46 years old. I'm working on a doctorate. I've got five kids. You know, a growing church. There's a lot. So I don't have a ton. But I've watched those movies with him, right, because that's one of the things we do. And so, but yeah, Captain America, man, there's just something about I'm a boy from the Midwest, just straightforward, good old fashioned, all American hero that appeals to me. And you know, that's consistent with just who I am too, even in my ministry. Not a lot of frills, not a lot of flash, not, you know, we just, man, we want to teach you the Bible. We want to be the hands and feet of Jesus. That's who we want to be.
Where can people find you guys?
Yeah, so stationhillchurch.com is the best place to go, website. We stream services online on Sunday. We worship gather 9 o'clock, 10:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Sundays. Lots of helpful information on the website. You can reach out to me, email as well as on there, if you want to connect with me personally. If something I shared today resonated with you, I would love to have that conversation.
You doing the gram and TikTok and all that stuff?
So I'm out there, but no, again, not a lot of time for social media. I use it more as research, really. Mm-hmm. What are people going through? What are they talking about? It's, you know, a form of cultural exegesis is the fancy term that we use.
Less about you, more about them.
That's pretty biblical.
But you've got good messages to share, so maybe you should start. That's what I'm thinking. Anyway, man, I really do appreciate you coming out to the compound.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, buddy. Check him out. Definitely stationhillchurch.com. right?
That's it.
It's.com. And check us out as well. What's Your Problem Podcast.com. Again, this is a video and audio podcast. If there's a guest that you want us to kind of entertain and bring on, let me know. You can hit us up. We've got contact information there. Review, like, share, and subscribe, all those fun things that we do. And hey, man, give me a review. I mean, if it's 2 or 3 star, I'm good with it. It's a review. I mean, can't please everybody. Again, Jay, thanks for coming out, brother.
Thank you for having me.
Brother Jay.